Hey guys, I'm Adam Rappaport, and this is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. All right, this week we've got food director Carla Lally-Music chatting with associate editor Christina Che about how steaming is the most overlooked technique in the cooking game and why it shouldn't be. And then senior food editor Andy Baragani talks to cookbook author Cal Petronell, who just published his third cookbook, Almonds, Anchovies, and Pancetta, a vegetarian cookbook, kind of. Cal focuses on how meat should be a supporting player in your meals and less of the main ingredient. The book is also the second pick for our monthly cookbook club here at Bon Appetit. If you haven't checked it out already, you should. Just go to bonappetit.com and search cookbook club, and we will tell you all about it there. And with that, let's do this thing.
Christina Che.
Carla Music.
I feel like if we're going to talk about steaming, one of the questions I wanted to ask just to kind of like find out what kind of a person are you is when you go to like the Turkish baths or the Korean bathhouse or any kind of a bathing like destination, are you sauna or steam room?
100% steam. Always and forever. Although, to be fair, there's something to be said for rotating. It's like, you know, if you're like kind of steaming and then you want to like do the dry thing, like kind of rotate
or
back
like
and
do
forth.
A plunge pool and then do a little dry
it's
and
like
then go back.
It's a whole circle of life within the three rooms.
And I feel like,
what are you?
Well, if I had to choose a number one, it would be a sauna. So I guess if I were a food, I want to be in a dry roasting method. And I think it's like apropos that you would choose steaming because you, in fact, are one of the people who like made me think about steaming differently.
I love steaming. Body and food.
Body and mind. But you wrote like an ode to steaming in the magazine that at the time I was like, you know, steaming is one of those things that I feel like got a leftover, like an abuse of a cooking method through dietetic recipe ends, you know? See, I grew up, I came of age in the 80s where I also think was like a very peak calorie counting, like the beginning of being super specific about what you ask for in a restaurant era. Mm. And asking for a plate of steamed vegetables was a way that someone who hates pleasure could go out to eat and order food that was like somehow safe or like not bad for you. And so I grew up thinking that that was a pleasure deprivating kind of approach to everything. And so the cooking that I grew up with was like everything started with like, you know, a quarter inch of olive oil and five cloves of garlic. Mm-hmm. And that was how most of the cooking that I grew up eating, I thought, started with that. But the steaming method, when you wrote about it, it was a very eye-opening thing because you talked about the method, but then also talked about how steamed food, the right way to pair it was with a very punchy, very flavorful sauce that mm-hmm. would kind of go with everything, but that it was just like a great way to cook, especially on the weeknight, because steam is very high heat and it's very moist heat. And so it's like it's a great way to cook like almost any type of food. It cooks it quickly so it doesn't have time to dry out, but it also imparts all this like steam and liquid so it doesn't dry out.
Yeah, I feel like it just creates that sort of steam room environment for like, you know, whatever you want to do, whether it's a vegetable, whether it's like a piece of fish. And I feel like the cool thing about steaming is that it does, I think, give you a certain amount of control that someone like me, who is very particular, I think, about not wanting to overcook something, I like being able to open something and like check on it, you know, and like poke around, which
it's
I feel
also
like
fast.
And it's super fast.
Yeah.
But I feel like whenever I have something in the oven, I don't know if this is true, but I feel like I'm always just like, once it's in the oven, I like can't open it and I can't look at it and I can't poke around because like, all this heat's going to like
right.
come out.
That's
and I'm going to like mess it up.
Yeah. I mean, it's not true that you would mess it up, but it is true that an oven, when you open the door, is going to drop like 30 to 50 degrees. So you can't be constantly checking around in there. You do have to trust a certain amount that the things are happening. But yeah, steaming. So let's let's break it down a little bit. I also think that there's an important distinction that came up recently between steaming as kind of just the technique, like the pure technique or method of steaming, versus steaming as part of a preparation where what's actually happening when the food is cooking is steaming, but it's not what maybe you think of when you just think steamed food. Okay. So when someone says steaming to me, immediately it's bring 2 inches of water to a simmer in a stock pot, fit with a steamer basket or bamboo steamer, but that you're creating steam, obviously, right, through mm-hmm. a small amount of water and then putting the food on a surface where the steam can pass through. So if you have one of those little steamer inserts that like collapse open, which is mostly what I used, or there's some little inserts that go right into the pan that have the holes in them, or the bamboo steamer basket, or now they have those really beautiful fancy ceramic steamer pots.
The Gia brand or
they're
whatever.
So pretty.
That we mentioned in that story.
Yeah.
That are like $200,
but
wow. They're beautiful. and I don't have those. I am 100% pro the collapsible steamer basket.
Yeah.
Which I kind of realized like later on, I feel like after I moved, I moved apartments for like once a year for like 6 years. In the process, I just had to like shed so much just like crap.
Yeah.
And like in the process, I was just like, okay, 3-tiered bamboo steamer that I bought one time to make Alex Lau's mom's soup dumplings for a party because I thought that was cool.
That's why, like, I have mine. We had a dumpling party and I bought 3 steamer baskets.
And like, to be fair, for dumplings in specific, I think that's like the move.
Yeah.
Because because you can do so many of them at once and you have the tiers, the steam moves really kind of beautifully throughout all the levels. It like rises to the top and it cooks everything through, and you can make like 20 dumplings at once or something.
Totally.
So in that
and
sense,
those are,
it makes
they're
sense.
Lightweight, they're inexpensive, they last a really long time, they're easy to clean. Like, it is a great device.
Yeah. But then I was just like, I can't be transporting this to another apartment just to like bury it in like a corner and never look at it again. So now I feel like I just use the $5 collapsible steamer basket that I got like on the Bowery at like the restaurant supply store.
And it's metal.
And actually, it's broken. When I first bought it, and a lot of steamer baskets I think are like this, they're collapsible and they have a little metal rod that comes up through the top with like a little ring on the top, so you can kind of latch onto the ring and like
they tip over every time. But yes, I think that's what that ring is for.
So somehow like mine broke, that rod broke off of my basket. And then I found out, oh, I can put a lot more things in here now that rod isn't like in the way.
Oh, because it's not going through the center point.
It's just like a totally
flat
surface. Nice. So I was like, oh, wow, like I can put fish in here. I can put a bowl in here and steam things in the bowl, which will like,
I think
eggs
in a very like pre-steamer any kind of basket life, I did balled up pieces of aluminum foil in the bottom of the pot and then put a plate, rested a plate on top of that and put the food on the plate.
I like that.
But it was still circulating around, but not like through. It wasn't ideal. But at any rate, the point is that you have steam, which is very high heat. You have a closed environment and you have food that is adjacent to but not sitting in that simmering water.
Right. The food is never touching the water.
And, you know, it's great for all of those reasons that we just said. It's like there's almost no cleanup. It's very quickly comes to temperature. It's a very quick method. It's a very forgiving method. And it's like a very multi-purpose method. So I had been kind of inspired to like, why don't I steam things more often? Like, not thinking about the things. There are things that I always steam. Mm-hmm. Like the best way to cook a whole lobster is not boiling, but steaming.
Totally.
Right. So it's like, once you start like going through it, and artichokes also is a food that even when I was in a pre-steam appreciation point in my life, always steamed artichokes.
Can you imagine
people boil them?
Oh,
and they get
thing?
So waterlogged and like,
that's very strange for me.
And terrible. So yeah, steaming an artichoke, like that seems like it makes the most amount of sense. Then when I was working on my cookbook, which isn't out yet, but
this
will
is obviously
be.
My favorite chapter already.
The book is called Where Cooking Begins, and one of the things I really wanted to do was go through like all the basic methods. And when I sat down to make that list, it was like obviously steaming gets to be at the party, you know, because it is this like basic, very approachable, essential master method. It just doesn't get like a ton of appreciation. So in the process of working on the book, I steamed so many things and then was like, I should be steaming everything all the time, even chicken breast, which was like the ultimate mm-hmm. Jane Fonda I'm being difficult at a restaurant order of like steamed chicken breast, which is just, you know, the most, I don't know, the most make funnable kind of thing you could order in your life is delicious.
I mean, it kind of makes sense when you really think about it. Here's a piece of meat that has virtually no fat.
Right.
It has no like protection if you expose it to like generally, I feel like all kinds of heat, right? Like you throw it in an oven, like, it's going to get dry.
Yes.
Like you throw it into, you boil
even,
it, like it's.
Even a hard sear, like if you're making a cutlet, it needs to be in the pan for a very short amount of time or it is 100% going to dry out.
And I feel like people are always just like, chicken breast, like so dry, like blah, blah. And it's just like, so why don't you just cook it in the wet room?
Right.
AKA the steamer. Where like
I
none
know.
Of that moisture
All
can
these
like
chicken breasts like thought escape. They loved the sauna.
These
turns out they need to go.
They're steamers.
They are total steamers. So wait, let's talk about the no protection part though, because the chicken breast with the skin versus skinless, boneless.
Oh, yes. And I wanted to talk to you about this, too, because of a recipe that we have. But you go first.
No, that was what I want to talk about. Like, which, what is, I feel like you want to stack the deck just even for just a little bit of protection on the chicken breast. And because it is so lean, but steamed chicken skin looks pretty crazy.
I feel like it also, I've never eaten it.
I don't think the texture in the end is necessarily something to celebrate, but I feel like having it there as insulation during the process is a good idea.
Yeah.
What was the recipe that made you think about this?
So the game-changing steamed chicken breast recipe for me was one that we published in 2016. It was in that Japanese home cooking primer story.
That was January.
Yes, yeah. January 2016.
Beautiful story.
One of the cooking techniques that they focused on in that story, I think, was about steaming. And the recipe that we ran with it was this sake steamed chicken and kabocha squash. And there are like three things that I think are really cool about this recipe. One, you're actually steaming not in water, but you're steaming in a flavored liquid, in this case, the sake.
Right.
It is subtle, but I think you do taste the difference when you have those like other flavors going on in the steam.
Really aromatic, a little bit sweet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The second thing that I feel like is cool is that it's a recipe in which you can steam both a protein and a vegetable at the same time, and they finish cooking together, and then you're just ready to eat. And then the third thing that I thought was well, not cool. I thought it was interesting, is that they do actually ask for skin on chicken breasts. And if you look at that photo, like the skin looks insane.
It's very dimpled.
It's like
goose dimples.
It almost looks like raw in a way. You know, it's like it still like maintains its like.
Right. It's the
dotted,
color doesn't really change.
You know, like,
yeah. Goose dimpled isn't a word, but, you know, yeah, let's go with that.
So I wasn't actually clear. It's not actually clear whether you're supposed to eat it with the skin or not, but I do not.
So I think that it depends on what you like and don't like. I think you can totally pull it off afterwards if you don't like it. But I also think that there's something comforting, if that's your jam, to that kind of soft and like a little bit gelatinous texture, which when we did it, and now I'm looking at the picture from the technique page of the book. Yeah, we have the skin is definitely on, because I feel like, again, it's imparting a little bit of flavor. Fat, I always say, like, is flavor, carries heat. It's a little bit of an insulation. If you end up pulling it off at the end, like, that's fine. So if you buy a bone-in, skin-on chicken breast, great. If you buy boneless, skinless, it will also still work. The cooking time might be a little bit different. Mm-hmm. The other thing we did, there were two other recipes that we did, or not even recipes, just preparations in the book. One was we did a block of silken tofu and just steamed that. And it was just such an easy way, especially with silken tofu, which if you try to handle it in any way, it just is going to fall apart, which is really nice in a soup or something else. But there was something really nice about just steaming it and having it come to temperature and then be really simply, like, you can sauce it with anything you want and then spoon it. And it was, like, really lovely, and I loved that. And then the other thing, which came up in research, I think originally founded in America's Test Kitchen, is that you can steam eggs and make hard-boiled eggs in a steamer, which is an amazing way to do, like, a large volume of hard-boiled eggs.
And you know I have feelings about this.
Let's talk about it.
Because we talked about this yesterday. Okay, so my thing, this blew my mind also. I also only learned about steaming eggs, like, in the last year or whatever. And it took me a really long time as a cook to understand that heat in any of its forms is, it's all heat. Like, it's all, like, the same thing that cooks food.
Right.
Whether that be heat from a pot of boiling water or the dry heat of an oven or, like,
fry
steam.
Fry oil. Yeah.
Or fry oil. All of it just, all of it works in the same way to, like, cook the thing.
Right.
And so when I thought about the concept of steaming eggs, it was just like, oh, this makes so much sense.
I know. But it never occurred to me because I had never ever seen anyone do it or, you think, had them. But unlike a pot of boiling water, where when you put, you know, a dozen eggs into, you displace a lot of water. You bring the temperature of the water way down quickly. It takes a while to come back. And then they're, like, clinking and clacking all over the place. And, you know, the shells get cracked. And then you get the weird, like, mohawk of egg white sticking through the thing.
I'm so upset by
so that. That just doesn't happen in a steamer. And say you're my mom and you need to do 7 dozen eggs for Easter decorating. Or, like, I'm throwing a party and planning to do 8 dozen pickled eggs, I'm going to steam them.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes about 12 minutes. And they come out great. So that's another, like, more love for the steamer.
I cannot prove this, but I would also say anecdotally that it seems more likely that the eggs are going to stay in their sort of nicely intact yolk right in the middle of the egg, you know, form. Because I feel like things just kind of, like, happen when they're in the boiling water, you know? They just
they get,
like,
turned
said,
around.
They do. They get all tripped up. And then sometimes you just end up with this weird, the one weird egg where it's just like, oh, the yolk's over there? You know? And it's just like, it doesn't affect the end product, obviously, but it's...
Right. Okay, so those are ways to take virtually any food that you've boiled, simmered, roasted, sautéed, and instead of doing that to it, put a couple of inches in a pot, insert your steamer basket, bring it to a simmer, put the food in there, get a hacksaw and take the little knob off of your steamer basket so you can get, you know, fish, also very forgiving, beautiful method for that. And then put the lid on and, you know, smaller pieces of vegetables are going to take 6 to 7 minutes. A whole chicken breast might take more like 10 to 12, but nothing is really hanging out for that long. So online we have a recipe for, like, a perfectly steamed lobster, and I think for a pound and a quarter we said like 8 minutes. I think a whole globe artichoke might take 35 to 40, but that's, like, definitely on the long end. But like Christina said, just go in and check it out. Okay, now let's talk about steaming that is happening even though you think you're just, like, cooking.
Yes.
I'm talking about clams.
Yes. That's, like, a thing we do already. We just don't know we're steaming.
Right. So any, like, clams for linguine with clams where you do, like I said, you're starting with olive oil and garlic, and then you put, like, a little bit of white wine, and you put your clams in there, and you cover it, basically... you're creating a steaming environment.
I don't know of any other way to cook clams, if I'm being honest. You know what I mean? It's just like...
That's the way.
That's the only way I've ever been taught.
Right. And I think cooking mussels that way is the same.
Anything that opens its shell.
Right. And then that liquid adds it into the rest of the steaming liquid.
Oh, right. Which I feel like is another thing, too, that often gets overlooked in the conversation about steaming is there are a lot of ways, I feel like, to make really good use of that liquid that you're cooking in.
Most people probably discard it.
And you know what? Honestly, a lot of the times I will too. But in that sake steamed chicken that we were talking about, I think you actually, you pour the broth over the chicken and the squash.
Right.
Because it's just been scented by, it's sake and chilies and ginger. And it's cooking in the simmering liquid as the steam from the liquid is cooking the protein and the vegetables up on top. Everything's like doing so much.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, not only do you have protein and vegetables, but you also have soup. It's like, are you kidding? Like, yeah.
All of the things.
That's how I see it anyway. I mean, I think it's similar to the way that people, you know, we really did kind of have to work hard to convince the world to save our pasta water. Just these things that we like subconsciously have grown up discarding as we cook, and they're liquid gold.
Right. They have quality. So maybe the liquid from steaming your artichoke, which was just kind of a way to get to the end of the road there, might not taste amazing. But when you're making a meal in your steam basket, like the page that you wrote about for the magazine, where you have different kinds of vegetables all together, the basis of the whatever liquid those things give off could maybe get stirred into a dipping sauce or become some kind of, you know, you could even just like melt a little bit of butter and season that with salt and pepper.
Totally.
And then that would be like a delicious sauce for your steamed food.
Yeah. I feel like that also just gets at one of the key points, which is I feel like we're not advocating steaming as a way of getting away from fat and flavor. It's like steam, get the fat and flavor for somewhere else.
Yes.
And pour it all over that stuff and like go to town.
Totally.
And I feel like ultimately, especially with vegetables, turnips or squash or like broccolini or what have you, there's something really like elegant to me about the way that they cook in steam and
yeah.
just kind of end up tasting, they taste like more of themselves than you can ever get, I think, from roasting them in an oven or, you know, other certain like dry heat applications
yeah.
where it's like, you know, it's still a delicious thing and maybe it caramelizes and browns and stuff, but it becomes something else.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that something else, but it's just kind of a different way of looking at something where maybe like, you know, if you've grown up roasting, hard roasting squash all your life,
steaming for a try.
Steaming
is hands down my favorite way to cook sweet potatoes.
Oh my God. Same.
Especially
a Japanese sweet potato.
Which are so starchy. Like in a great way, but they have more starch than garnet yam or what, you know, an orange sweet potato.
And they like dry out.
And they dry out in the oven and they get all like leathery. But when you steam them, there's no moisture loss. In fact, there's a moisture gain. And they are, the texture is so silky and amazing. And then with something like that, I just want to slather miso and butter all over them. So to your point, fat and flavor like being added. So it's like choosing a method that's going to be great for the thing you're cooking. And then choosing a sauce or an accompaniment that's just going to like up the ante altogether. Another example is online steamed artichokes with garlic butter recipe. Because the artichoke has no fat added to it while it's cooked, but then you dunk
and
every...
And it's nasty. Like, I don't want to eat like a... I don't want to eat a naked steamed artichoke. No, thank you.
But then you get to dunk every single leaf in garlic butter.
And I just realized that's what you do to lobster.
Exactly.
Truly, I think the moral of this cast is steam your thing and then serve it with a side of butter.
And salt. And spice. It just makes me hungry for steamed food. And it just makes me think about, like, again, the Turkish bathhouse. Like, do you want to do the method that's going to make you, you know, plump and smooth everything out and make your skin, like, super dewy? Or are you choosing the method that, like, honestly, you could get, like, a little dry down and wrinkly in there?
Well, which one are you going to choose the next time you go?
I think I want to stay hydrated.
I think that's a great choice.
All right. Well, thanks for inspiring more steaming in my life.
Thanks for bringing us more things to steam.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Today, I'm beyond thrilled to welcome the author of the New York Times bestseller, 12 Recipes, as well as the book, A Recipe for Cooking, and his newest book, Almonds, Anchovies, and Pancetta, a vegetarian cookbook, kind of. He's also the host of the podcast, Cooking by Ear. He was the chef of Chez Panisse for over 20 years, where I met him at age 16. Welcome to the podcast, Cal Peternell.
Thanks, Andy. So good to be back and good to see you again.
Good to see you. I have to say, like, this is beyond surreal. It's like a 360. I couldn't believe it when I knew that you were coming. I think I just have to get it over with. And I don't think I formally did this in my teens. But if you only knew how much you had an influence on me at that age, I feel like I've been telling people for years and years of Chez Panisse and you and... Mm-hmm. what you did and how you influenced the way I cook, and to see you now and now with your third book and influencing so many people around the country and around the world and how they cook, it brings me so much joy.
Well, you're welcome. And, you know, we have lots of visitors through the kitchens at Chez Panisse. And, of course, I had many interns and helpers over the 20-plus years that I was there. There's some people who you can tell really, like, get it right away, they get what we're doing, and the not the, you know, certainly the food, the beautiful produce, the attention to detail and the artistry that's represented through all the cooks there, but also just the culture of enjoyment and learning and finding pleasure in food. And it seems like you really were one of those ones who got it off the bat.
Thank
even
you.
At 16 years old. Still in high school.
Still in high school. Yeah. The book is called Almonds, Anchovies, and Pancetta. And the book is divided up really with those three ingredients. Each recipe kind of has at least one of these ingredients.
Right.
How did you kind of go about even deciding that that's how you wanted to kind of approach the book?
You know, I always had this like fantasy idea for a restaurant that would be called Anchovies and Pancetta. And those would be the only kinds of meats that were served there. And I was talking at an event for my last book at 92nd Street Y, and someone asked me, you know, what's next for you? And I said, maybe I'm going to do this restaurant called Anchovies and Pancetta. And I described it, and my agent and editor were there, and they were like, well, that could be a good cookbook. And I was like, okay, don't say it if you don't mean it. So I went with the idea, and, you know, it's the way I like to eat. I think a lot of people like to eat vegetable forward, lots of produce and grains and beans and greens, and then a little bit of the right kinds of meat as a seasoning, like thinking of meat as a seasoning. And so cured fish and cured pork are natural to use in that role. And almonds kind of deliver a similar kind of fat content and little flavor boost. So I added those in there too because I love to cook with almonds, and also I know there's a lot of people who are trying to eat a little more vegetarian. And even though there's not big chunks of meat in this book, you know, if you want to steer away from it, you can use the almond chapter. And then the anchovy and pancetta chapters too. Sometimes those things can be left out, or you can, in some cases, even substitute in almonds or some other nuts instead of the anchovies or pancetta.
This is your third cookbook. You've been cooking for so many years now, but how do you go about just going through kind of the recipe development aspect of writing a cookbook?
That's kind of the most fun part for me, because I just start thinking about the ingredients and thinking about what I cook at home and what other dishes that other people cook that I love that include, in this case, those ingredients. And then it just sort of starts to flow. One of the things I love about writing cookbooks is writing the introductions to the whole book and to the chapters and to the recipes. And I kind of gave myself a little permission with this one to kind of write whatever I wanted to write about and then almost kind of find the way that it led you back to the recipe, and sometimes it's quite tangential. But I love to use food as like a mnemonic device to bring up the stories of my childhood, of my life, of my own kids. And it really works for me, and it works for other people too. It's something we found on our podcast, Cooking by Ear, is that if you get in the kitchen with someone and you start and you get your hands on some ingredients, like stories start to flow. You know, you're cutting the onions and someone says, oh yeah, this is, my mother used to cut the onions this way. And then they start to tell some story about their mother or about the garden or about the first time they ever had something like this. And I think it's a wonderful thing. And, you know, it happens, of course, around the dinner table, we all know, when you kind of relax and begin to eat and maybe have a little wine. But it happens in the kitchen, too.
It's an indicator. Like, it just it touches on that kind of nostalgia or memory. And they kind of it's definitely easier for people to process, I imagine.
Yeah, and sometimes it's these memories will come up that really kind of surprised me. I remember I was writing about, for the first book, for 12 Recipes, I was writing about mashed potatoes. And, you know, I just sat there at my desk going, mashed potatoes, what are my... And all of a sudden, I remembered the story that my father-in-law had told me about how he was in the army and he was going through the mess hall and the mashed potatoes were just really terrible. He's a real mashed potato fan and likes them a certain way. Even then, I guess. And he complained and he kept giving the cook a hard time. And eventually the cook, he told me it was the only time he threw a punch because the cook threw something at him and he punched the cook. And, you know, that all came from mashed potatoes, like the first time my father-in-law punched somebody. So
we spoke earlier before the podcast and you were saying how there's no photos in this cookbook, but there are incredibly beautiful illustrations done by you, two of your sons, as well as your wife, Kathleen. What is the reason behind that?
I think for this book, the size of it and the feel of it, I wanted it to be really personal and kind of pretty in that way. And also, I just started to like do these drawings and, you know, I went to art school and I was a painter before I became a cook and have always kind of kept my hand in there a little bit. When I go on vacation, I do watercolor landscapes, and I started doing, you know, just illustrations of produce, and I got so much pleasure from it. I just thought, like, I should just do this. And of course, my wife is an artist and draws all the time, and our sons are too. It's something that we do when we go out to eat. If there's paper on the table, we all like to draw. So I think that's part of it. The other part, I think, is that and someone said this to me the other day, there's something about illustrations that are a little more timeless, or that maybe just don't indicate a certain era, whereas photography can kind of quickly look like it's from another era.
Oh, I know that feeling. I mean, just looking back a few issues, even 3-4 years ago, it's definitely when we were, you could tell where we were at in the magazine.
Yeah, which is okay, but I just felt like for this book, let's go with a different feel, and we had a great time doing it. Also, you know, the writing of the book sometimes can become, you know, at the sort of the end of the day, you kind of feel bogged down and you're having to like test recipes and rewrite the recipes, and to take a break and pick up the paintbrush and just sit there and look at a pepper and do a little painting of it was, I found, really relaxing and kind of refreshing.
You mention how there's a passage talking about a particular tool. It's my favorite tool, a mortar and pestle, and why, and you tell the reader that it's essential that you get this. Why is it such an essential tool for you?
Because I think, especially if you're going to cook from this book, especially the anchovy chapter, you should just get one, because they're not that expensive. And you can do the same thing on a cutting board with a knife, and you can mash up garlic with a little salt and make a paste, and then you can sort of chop and mash in the anchovies. But in a mortar and pestle, it just works so well. And it also, I don't know, it feels like it gets you in touch with some sort of primal tool. And they're usually quite beautiful, and they kind of make that little sound, and you feel a little bit like you're connecting with some ancient ancestor.
It gives you a sense of, I mean, my introduction to it was really etchy. I just remember there was like a line of them, there was like 4 or 5 of them that we used for everything from making sauces and pounding nuts and making garlic paste and It is definitely an essential tool.
Yeah.
And I think I've become notorious at BA for just like calling for mortar and pestle at my recipes, for my recipes.
I know. I'm in somebody's kitchen and I sort of sheepishly say like, you don't have a mortar and pestle, do you? And a lot of times people are like, no.
What are you, like a
pharmacist from like the 1800s or something? But it's like, well, you should get one. And, you know, there's lots of kinds. I have three different ones at my house. I have a little one that I use for, like, if I toast spices and grind those up. I have a wooden one that's just the right size for, like, dressing for a couple of people. And then I have one of those beautiful, you know, the green kind of granite ones.
Oh, yeah.
That's much bigger and is great for making, like, pounding anchovies and garlic. But, you know, they're really good for making mayonnaise and aioli, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Which is a weird thing that the two things that you can make aioli with are a whisk, which of course has many parts, or a pestle, which is just one
solid
thing.
Yeah.
But they both work.
Huh.
Yeah.
One of the ingredients, anchovies, has been a long debate at BA. If I remember correctly, it was probably maybe 2 years ago. I feel like we were closing a particular issue. It was probably winter, late, and our editor-in-chief, Adam, just kind of came in, went to our food director's office, Carl Lally Music, and said, like, we got to make anchovies optional now on all recipes. And from there on, whenever we call for anchovies, we say optional. What are your thoughts on that?
I think, people who say they don't like anchovies, I think they really do like anchovies. They just haven't quite had them in the right context. And one thing about anchovies is that they do, as soon as you open the jar or the can, the clock starts ticking. And
immediately.
They oxidize pretty quick, and they change, their flavor changes and gets a little kind of metallic and, of course, fishier in a not good way, in a way that I think people usually react to negatively. But if you get some good quality anchovies, you know, open the can and use them right away, I've won converts. Even kids who you think might not be into it. Like, I've made a banha cauda, you know, banha cauda, the sort of garlic anchovy sauce that you make with oil and butter. And
which can be quite aggressive.
Yeah, you can make it at whatever level. But you do kind of cook the anchovies for that, so it changes their nature a little. And I've seen, I've had dinner parties where you serve that, and, you know, it's typically served with raw vegetables, and everyone sits around and dips the vegetables into the banha cauda. And even little kids start going for it.
It's one of those ingredients that I was not raised with. I didn't really grow up eating a lot of seafood. And it's something that I always have in my kitchen. I'm addicted to it. I could eat them on their own, a little bit of oil.
You know, in the anchovy chapter, there's lots of anchovies, but there's also some other cured fish ingredients like botarga, which, as you know, is the pressed and salted roe, fish roe. There's bonito, which is like smoked and dried tuna that you can shave. And there's fish sauce. And they're not exactly interchangeable, but to some extent they kind of are. Is there a Persian equivalent?
Really, they eat the only kind of seafood dishes you see are in the south. You will see the north by the Caspian, but I feel like
it's just caviar.
A lot of lamb in that country and chicken. And
but
beef.
Not really like a salted fish ingredient that's used like as a seasoning, the way fish sauce is.
I was deprived. There's so many other items like the pickles and the jams, and there's so many other things that they preserve and the sour ingredients. But no, I always crave the kind of, and now like I eat seafood majority of the days of the week. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about your podcast, Cooking by Ear, where you're the host and you've had incredible guests. Your first guest was Frances McDormand. I think your most recent guest was Big Frida. I actually have a connection with her.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. When I had a brief stint in fashion, I worked as a fashion stylist and assisted styling her for an event.
Oh, were you in here or in New Orleans?
No, this is in New York. Oh, okay. Yeah. But you are cooking alongside them in their kitchens. and the listener is able to cook with you.
Yeah.
So it's an hour-long podcast. How did you even think of that format?
The birth of the cooking by ear happened. I was with a friend. We were actually on a beer run from a wedding where they had run out of drinks, and we were talking about cooking, and he said, you know, I love to make lentils, but it takes me like 6 hours to make a pot of lentils, and I end up drinking 3 bottles of wine, and it's just like a wipeout. And I said, you know, I got you. Like, I'm going to show you how to do that different. And he's like, he has a background in media, and he's like, this could be a podcast we could teach people to cook. And we tried a couple different formats, and we eventually settled on this one where, because I felt like there wasn't really something like that out there, where you can cook along and that it happens in real time. So it was a combination of that desire to teach people to cook and then my own affection for radio and for listening to like NPR programs and things like and podcasts when I'm in the kitchen. I really liked that. And I thought, oh, like what if, you know, you could have fresh air with a great interview, but you could also be cooking with it instead of I'm just cooking whatever I am and cooking and listening to the interview. What if it was somehow integrated? And it's turned out to be for us a great way to get access to the guests that we like. You know, we always try and pick an interesting guest, and we've done some celebrities, but they don't really need to be a celebrity. It just needs to be somebody who's interesting and has a good story to tell. But the fact that, you know, our pitch is we'll show up at your house, we'll bring our bag of groceries, you don't have to do any prep beforehand, we'll cook with you, we'll teach you to cook something, then we'll all sit down and eat, and we'll do the dishes, and then we'll leave 3 or 4 hours later, and they don't have any homework after, is an easier ask. Plus, it's audio, so they don't have to, like, you know, comb their hair or mm-hmm. anything. So that has, I think, gotten us in the kitchen door of a lot of our guests. And then, like I said, the act of cooking with people, I think, engenders storytelling and tends to kind of let their guard down. They relax a little in a way that if you're just sitting across from somebody interviewing them, it can feel a little stiff or a little difficult to kind of get to a level. But when you're both like picking the herbs or tipping the beans together, you're like a little distracted and the stories tend to flow more.
Yeah, and you have something going on.
Yeah, you got something going on. It's like, I know with my kids, it's like when we're in the car and we're all facing the same way, we're not like looking right at each other, I can get a little more information out of them sometimes. So I think it's that kind of thing. And you know, Frida was amazing. And we went to her kitchen in New Orleans. And I don't know if she didn't really completely see what our concept was, or if she just wanted to teach us, because usually I teach my guests to cook something. But in the case of Big Frida, she taught me how to make booty pop and potatoes. And she gave me a twerk lesson. I'm not going to say she taught me to twerk because I can't twerk. Unfortunately, part of that was captured on video, which I hope has been destroyed. But it's gotten us into some great places. And we have season 2 is in the works. It should be out in November.
That's so exciting.
Yeah.
It's hard not to talk about your life and your career without bringing up Chez Panisse. Mm. You left how many years ago?
Just about a year ago.
A year ago.
A little over a year ago, yeah. 22 years. Almost 22 years I was there.
I mean, I guess with any job, how could, after being there for so long, but you know, I know, and for our listeners, Chez Panisse is not your regular restaurant. How would you describe it?
I think the thing that I always thought, like from the very first time I went to Chez Panisse, I felt like that was like going to a friend's house who, it turns out, is just an amazing cook, you know? And because it has that sort of like the best version of home cooking feel to it. You know, the plating is pretty straightforward, not too many like bells and whistles kind of thing. So I think that's the kind of feel of the place. And I think the dining rooms are kind of like that as well. But of course, the most remarkable thing about Chez Panisse and the thing that I think has made it what it is the food is delicious. And it's very of the place. You know, we're so lucky living in the Bay Area, as you know, that we have access to just the most incredible ingredients, especially produce. And so our cooking starts at the marketplace. And, you know, a lot of people are doing this now. But back when Chez Panisse, when Alice first started Chez Panisse, and through those first years, it was kind of a new thing. So to start at the market, not start with the recipe, but see what's good and what the farmers have brought, and to build your menu and your dishes in a way that shows off those ingredients as best you can. Almost get out, and sometimes get out of their way and let them just be what they are, and find that balance between bringing something special to it, but also really honoring and respecting the quality of the ingredients. I think that's what Chez Panisse has done. And man, it has really spawned a lot of other businesses, right? Like the alumni are all over the country.
All over. There's this openness. I mean, I felt safe. Maybe not the very, very first day when I had to, like, I don't know, it was like two buckets of onions.
Yeah.
I had to prep, but I'm very fortunate of growing up in a household where cooking was a big thing with my mother and my father. But I always say that Chez Panisse provided this kind of extended foundation. It taught me how to cook.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's important to talk about that a little bit, that you were saying that it felt like a safe space. And kitchens can be pretty intense, and as we all know, there's been some abuse that's gone on in kitchens. And through my career, I've worked with in a lot of kitchens that are headed by women. I think they tend to be, not always, there's some, you know, there's some exceptions, but they tend to be a safer space, a place where people feel welcome, and certainly at Chez Panisse, there's a lot of respect that goes on there, and everyone keeps it at that level at all times. And, you know, one of the things that when we have lots of visitors there, both 16-year-old high school students and accomplished chefs from, you know, visiting from all over, and culinary school students and everyone in between. And one of the things that especially the chefs who've come from other restaurants always say is like, wow, like what an incredible staff of like devoted people. Like everybody there is kind of on it. And there's not a lot of people who are there because they just needed a job. They're there because they love food and they really want to like learn how to cook it the best way.
And be a part of that family.
And to be a part of that family and you know, like to have nice people. And that's something I've learned and I'm hopefully going to pass on to the people that I teach along the way.
I think that's all the time we have today, but I can't thank you enough, Cal. It's been beyond a pleasure. Again, his newest book is Almonds, Anchovies, and Pancetta, a vegetarian cookbook, kind of. Yeah. Thank you, Cal.
Yeah, thank you.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che, and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.